The lecture today goes back to our second 10 terms, and we're going to hit four of those 10 terms that we've talked a little about, but we haven't really dealt with as thoroughly as I think is appropriate to do. So we're going to be using a case study, and we're going to be looking at four of those terms, and I will forewarn you that a substantial part of the lecture today is going to be asking you to respond to those four terms and to have some discussion as has gotten better and better and better through the semester, and a much broader number of you have been participating in that. But today I really want to see if we can step it up one more level and really get some sense of what of these four terms are you interested in utilizing, and how can it help you in creative problem solving. So we're going to be looking at a case study of a guy named John Stevens and his involvement in the Panama Canal. I would venture to say there's not a single person in the room who knows who John Stevens is. Anybody know about John Stevens? Okay, that's a good thing, because I want to make the point that this is just an ordinary guy out there. He was an engineer. He was really, really good at what he did, and he did a magnificent job of a very, very, very mammoth task, and one that has been incredibly important in the economic development of the world in the 20th and 21st century. So we're going to be focusing on really this incredibly difficult task of building the Panama Canal. And this lecture is going to be about these four words: collaboration, which we talked about when we introduced those second 10 terms. Collaboration is working with one another in a cooperative kind of way. It's more than one person doing the same task, solving the same problem together. Now, that means that we're sitting down as equals. We're brainstorming, we're exchanging ideas back and forth. We're solving a problem together. It is true, real collaboration. Sometimes we use that term incorrectly, but what we're talking about here is where it's multiple people getting together and working as one. All of our brains working together to solve this problem in a kind of holistic way. So collaboration is one of the things we want to talk about. A second is teamwork. And that's a very different thing. That is a coordinated effort on the part of a group. So it's multiple people solving a problem, but they're not doing it as a single unit. They're breaking the problem apart. They're assigning different tasks. Each team member has a certain job to do, and collectively, they solve the problem. But it is not collaboration. It is teamwork. This is just like on a sports team, like a football team. Somebody's playing the role of the quarterback. That's a very different role than the role of the tight end. That's a very different role than the role of the left tackle. Each of these people has their own job, their own skills, their own capabilities, and collectively, as a team, they solve the problem. But it is not everybody trying to do the same thing. And in fact, in teamwork, it doesn't work very well if I'm the right tackle and I'm trying to do the quarterback's job, that's not a good thing. I need to do my job, and I need to understand my role as a part of a larger team. Very different thing than collaboration. The third term we're going to be looking at is leadership. And that, the dictionary definition, guiding, directing, acting as head, the hierarchical coordination of a project. And this is actually taking the role of, I have the primary responsibility here. It's my job to lead the solution to this problem. And I need to coordinate other people and help them in making contributions to that, but I am the leader in that situation. And again, that's a very different role to play than collaboration or than teamwork. Leadership is a distinctly different set of skills and set of capabilities that you bring to the table. Then the fourth term we're going to be looking at is power. And the dictionary definition here that we're looking at is strength or might or force. It's the possession of control or command. So this is again very different than the other three. Power is not leadership. That is not coaxing or coordinating or bringing people together. It is actually just exerting power. All right, I have the ability to make this happen, kind of whether people want to go along with it or not. It is actually power. Now, this one is hard for many people to accept. This one is not in my past experience in this class. This is a hard sell for me to convince you that power might be an appropriate and interesting capability to develop in terms of creative problem solving. But I don't want us to, I want us to try not to look at this as power doesn't mean kind of meanness or ego kind of thing necessarily. And I think John Stevens is an excellent example here because this was not a big ego guy. He didn't want to be famous. He wasn't in this for himself. And yet he understood that power was extremely important in solving the problem. And power doesn't have to be like you're smashing somebody else. That's not what power necessarily is. Power is simply exerting, having the ability to trump the point of view or the input of someone else. And to say, I'm sorry, in this case, I'm playing the trump card. And I've got the power, and I'm going to exert it, and that's what's going to happen. And maybe that's the way to solve the problem. And that's absolutely essential in solving the problem. So through this, the beginning of this lecture, I want you to be thinking about collaboration, about teamwork, about leadership, about power. Who am I as a human being? What am I good at? What do I feel comfortable doing? What do I maybe wish I was a little better at? But how could I use these four tools? And what role might they play in me becoming a better creative problem solver? Okay, so this lecture is about relinquishing complete control. It's about contingent solutions that others contribute to. And in many of the other case studies, we've looked at it very much from that individual's point of view. Today, we're very much talking, and certainly we've talked about mentorship, we've talked about competition, we've talked about these other ways that you interact with other people in creative problem solving. But today we really want to think about being in a problem solving situation where you relinquish complete control. You are doing it together with other people. And of course, this is hugely important in being good at creative problem solving, because there are many, many problems that are just too big for any one person to solve. If you're going to be the lone wolf and you're going to do it all by yourself, you're going to have to restrict yourself to fairly small problems. I would say this, I mean, I certainly know this as an architect. If you say, I'm going to be a creative individual architect, I'm going to be really good at designing very creative buildings, but I'm going to do it all by myself. I do not want anyone else interfering with my personal creativity. Then honestly, you're going to have to do little bitty buildings like houses or something. And even then, it's going to be very hard because, you know something, things are complicated and they require a lot of work, and it's just very, very difficult to have complete control. And I see this all the time with architecture students and with architects in practice, that they want that control. I want to be able to control this. I think to be a creative person, I've got to be able to control this and just be me, just me. That's what real creativity is. It's just about me. And if you have that attitude, you're going to have really small problems you deal with, because when they get more complex and more complicated and, you know, more demanding, you're not going to be able to handle it. And I mean, I was dean of the School of Architecture for 9 years, and I had a faculty member during the time I was dean. Freaking brilliant, brilliant guy. He was not an architect. He has a PhD in physics. And he was very, very interested in creating software that would analyze buildings' energy consumption and a lot of other parameters having to do with sustainability, and that you would have one single program that would give you data, give you feedback on a lot of different design issues. He had written, he was very highly recognized for having written one of the first energy performance model programs for the Department of Energy. And, you know, he was extremely accomplished. But this was in the baby years of doing computer modeling of energy performance. And in that first program, he could do that baby program all by himself. And God damn it, Paco loved that. I was in complete control. I wrote every line of code. I did this, and it was so clear and so perfect, and I could align everything just like I wanted it. But the next generation of software was going to be way, way, way more complicated and way more sophisticated. And he said, cool, I can do that. I'm going to do that. And he sits in his little office, and he has all his machinery around him, and he works his ass off. My God, that guy worked so hard. But at the very beginning of it, I said, Paco, you're going to have to get a team of people to do this, because this is going to be big and complicated and important, but you just can't do it all yourself. He said, no, I don't want to do that. I just can't rely on other people. It's got to be consistent, and it's got to be exacting, and it's got to be right, and so I have to do it myself. And he, you know, got a few modest grants. Nobody would give him a big grant if it's just him. And, you know, he wanted all this equipment. Okay, Paco, we'll give you the equipment. Okay, here's the equipment. He's not even utilizing it very heavily because he's just one guy. You could have eight people working on that equipment. But no, he's Mr. Control. You know, he had a great idea. He had all the firepower in his brain to make a huge creative contribution. But he could not collaborate. He could not do teamwork. He could not be a leader of other people. And as a result, the other teams of people who were also working on this kind of job, they just completely outpaced him. He was still trooping along trying to do baby steps, and they were 15 steps ahead of him because they had more people, they had more firepower, they had more capability, and they had more diverse strengths that they could bring to it. And he just got completely subsumed. He became irrelevant. His work was unimportant because everybody else was doing more sophisticated work than he was. That software got produced, and it got produced in a fantastic way, but it got produced by teams of 20 people working on that. Paco couldn't work that way. And that's really sad, super sad. So if you're going to work on larger and more complex and more sophisticated problems, these terms are highly, highly important. Collaboration, teamwork, leadership, and power. And it all has to do with creating contingent solutions that other people can contribute to, that you become a part of that. Okay, let's see how that worked in the case of John Stevens. So building the Panama Canal was begun by the French. And in the 19th century, the French had been by far the best engineers in the world. Their educational system was superior to everybody else's, and people trained in the French universities were the best engineers in the world. There were two huge projects that were extremely visible all over the world that documented the advanced engineering capability of France. One was the Suez Canal that had been built between 1854 and 1869, an enormous project really to connect the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea to make a much faster route between South Asia and Southeast Asia and Europe. Now you can go through the Suez Canal and get there directly instead of having to go way down below the bottom of Africa and come back up through the Atlantic. Huge game changer in the entire trade routes of the world, and huge economic stimulus for both Asia and Europe. This was a game changer, and the French were the ones that did it. They figured out how to engineer cutting this channel through the desert between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. And then the other thing that was extremely visible was the Eiffel Tower. And there was a huge French exposition in the latter part of the 19th century. The Eiffel Tower was the centerpiece of that. There was no real sophisticated steel construction before this. No tall buildings were made out of steel. The Bessemer process had been invented in the middle of the 19th century. They knew how to make steel, but to actually apply it and make a building out of steel or a structure out of steel, it just hadn't been done. And it was Gustav Eiffel, the great engineer, who was at the center of creating the Eiffel Tower. And then it became just a worldwide phenomenon. And for a very, very long time, up until the 1930s, for 50 years, it was the tallest structure in the world, was the Eiffel Tower. And the French were just way ahead of everybody else. So clearly, they were the people to build the Panama Canal. And after they'd finished the Suez Canal, this would be a similar kind of thing where you'd be able to cut down the distance of trade routes by going through the isthmus between North America and South America. And they knew how to do it. They'd done this canal before. They take it on and say, we're going to build the Panama Canal. And they put as the head of that effort a guy named Ferdinand de Lesseps. He was called the great engineer, although oddly enough, he had no credentials in engineering. He did not have a degree in engineering. He was not actually an engineer, but he was very good at orchestrating the process. And he had been absolutely essential in the Suez Canal. He'd been the man behind it. He'd started out there. A niece of his had married one of the powerful people in the Egyptian government. That gave him an in with the Egyptian government. And then he negotiated contracts between the Egyptian government and the French, this corporation they set up. He's the one who got all the financing for it. Brilliant, brilliant man. So he had done that on Suez, and then he just moves over and says, okay, now we're doing it at Panama. He was a real free hero, and so obviously he was the guy to do Panama, but he really doesn't have a strong technical background, but he's a very, very good leader in a situation like this. So they begin the effort, and for about 20 years, they work on the Panama Canal. But they failed, and there really were six reasons why they failed. So this was a horrible, horrible thing for the French. This basically was a worldwide embarrassment. They say, we're going to build the Panama Canal. They work on it for close to two decades, and they fail. They didn't do it. Six reasons. The first thing is perpetual problems with private financing. The way the Suez Canal had been built is Ferdinand de Lesseps would say, we need $200 million. We're selling bonds, and you can invest in the construction of the Suez Canal. So you as an individual French investor can put in $200,000 and you get a certain percentage of the business. And then when the Suez Canal starts charging for people to go through the Suez Canal, then you're getting your income back from that. And people in France made a freaking fortune. These were just ordinary people who were investors, and they were making tons of money off the revenue of the Suez Canal. So they say, okay, we're going to use the same model in the case of the Panama Canal. But the problem is that he estimated how much he thought it would cost, and he sold those bonds, and then they kept having cost overruns. So no, it wasn't going to cost $200 million. It was going to cost $250 million. So then I have to sell $50 million more of bonds, and that waters down the value of the other $200 million. And so people get pissed off. Wait, I thought I was going to get this percentage. Now I'm getting a lower percentage. And they had to refinance a couple of times because they had these big cost overruns. So he every time he tried to go back to the till for more money, it was very difficult, had a problem with private financing. The second thing is big political problems with Colombia. Panama was a part of Colombia at this point. And so he's negotiating with the Colombian government. It's a very unstable government. It keeps changing. He just cannot get a deal cut with the Colombian government. And that was perpetual aggravation. A third thing is they just could not decide on a route. We now look at where the Panama Canal cuts through and think, well, that was inevitable. No, it wasn't inevitable at all. That was a very difficult route. You had to go over the mountains where it is right now. And they were looking for a flatter route. So if you went a little farther north in Nicaragua, there was a much flatter route. And there was a big lake. So you could cut through to the lake, and then you could cut through from the lake to the Pacific Ocean, and it would be a much flatter route. And so for a very long time, they thought, yeah, the place is Nicaragua. And then, no, no, not Nicaragua, but there were other problems there. It was much longer. But exactly where the route would go, they had a lot of hassle over that and controversy over the decision they eventually made. And the fourth problem was they had a problem getting a workforce there. The local people in Panama were clueless about construction and honestly just weren't interested in doing anything different than what they'd done, which was subsistence farming. So we have a native population that is just fine with doing their subsistence farming. They don't want to be workers on a big construction site. And so there was really no local workforce available. So then they started bringing in workers from the Caribbean and to come in, and they needed someone who was accustomed to working in a tropical climate. You just couldn't get workers from Scandinavia who could come down and work in the heat and the humidity of Panama. So they're looking for people who are accustomed to the tropical climate, and they were getting workers from Jamaica and Barbados and these Caribbean islands. But these people would get tired of working and they'd just get on the next boat and go back home. And, you know, it was hard work and it was difficult circumstances. So there's a problem keeping a good workforce there. The fifth thing was there was a problem with the climate. It's just so hot and so humid. You can't really work an 8-hour day. You work about 4 hours and it just takes every bit of energy out of you. And it also is extremely rainy, and they're trying to do construction, and everything's full of mud, and you can't do construction during the rain, and there would be rainy seasons, and it was just terrible problems with the climate all the way along. And then the sixth and final thing was problems with disease. They had problems with malaria, with smallpox, with beriberi, with all of these tropical diseases. And it was especially a problem with the Frenchmen who came in and had no resistance whatsoever to these tropical diseases. And they catch them and they die. So terrible problem with diseases. Now, these were unique problems to Panama. That had not been a problem in Suez. They had had an available workforce. They did not have the climatic issues. It's a freaking desert. It doesn't rain there. It's hot, but it's not humid. They don't have tropical diseases in Egypt. So he had not confronted those particular problems, and when he confronted them in Panama, it was just insurmountable, and they have a very embarrassing defeat. Over 20,000 lives were lost in the French endeavor. So over that almost two decades, 20,000 people were killed trying to build the Panama Canal. One out of every four of the engineers, sorry, I'll give that statistic in a minute, but many, many of the French engineers died in that process. In fact, a whole generation of French engineers died, and it really reduced their engineering capability. The best and the brightest wanted to go to the most exciting engineering challenge. Well, that was the Panama Canal. So they go over there in masses, and they freaking get malaria and smallpox, and they die. And so many, many French engineers were killed. They spent $287 million, three times as much as they did on the Suez Canal, and they had virtually nothing to show for it. It caused many average citizens to lose their savings because, again, these people were investing in the bonds, and the bonds became worthless, and it was devastating to French economy and individual French people. It was a massive blow to the national ego and to their reputation as problem solvers, as creative people, as engineers. It was devastating. So three out of five French engineers died while they were in Panama. It was just a horrible, devastating thing for the country. Okay, that's the kind of challenge that's out there. After the French say, okay, we give up, they retreated back to France. And then in the presidential election of 1900, Teddy Roosevelt is running for president. And Teddy Roosevelt is this bully guy, you know, we can do, he's a really enthusiastic, pro-American kind of guy. And he says, yeah, the French couldn't do it, but we Americans, we can do this. We can build the Panama Canal. And that was a big platform of his campaign, was that if I become president, we're going to take on the Panama Canal and we're going to show the world that Americans are the new leaders in the world and we have this can-do attitude and we can make it happen. So he became president and then he had to pony up. And it took him a couple of years to get Congress to authorize him to purchase the rights to take up where the French left off. So basically they bought out the French company that had been established to build the Panama Canal, and they Congress authorized them to pay up to $40 million for it. And they did that. So now what they bought was a lot of equipment that was still there in Panama, digging equipment, and some land rights and land ownership that was there. So they bought that for $40 million. And then they started digging. Just went down there. How do you build the Panama Canal? Well, you dig the dirt out and you make a hole and you connect the two oceans. And they just started digging. And they didn't have any better luck than the French. He was a big risk taker, Teddy Roosevelt. But the canal was a very volatile issue, and he was using spin to try to convince people that it was a sure thing. But honestly, it wasn't a sure thing. And the initial efforts by the United States were not promising. And they were just basically doing the same thing the French did, just digging themselves into a deeper and deeper hole, spending a ton of money, but not getting the job done. Now, the one thing in that initial effort that did make some sense was that in 1904, William Gorgas was appointed to head efforts to fight the health problems. How can we reduce the death of our workforce from disease and from these infections. So he was hired to do it, but really he was barely making baby steps. And it was a really disastrous effort. For 2 years, the United States is invested in this, and they're working at it, and they're just not doing any better than the French did. William Gorgas was a bright light there. He was 49 years old. He was an expert on tropical diseases, and he was a big believer that mosquitoes carried yellow fever and malaria, and that you had to eradicate mosquitoes. Now, that was a radical, radical notion at the time. He was in a tiny minority of epidemiologists who believed that was promising. But there had been an experiment in Cuba where they had eradicated mosquitoes and they had reduced malaria and smallpox significantly in one little town in Cuba, an experiment there. They had no idea what the connection was, but they thought that there was a connection between mosquitoes and these tropical diseases. That was an isolated event. It was not proven by any means. William Gorgas believed in it, and he said, you know, what we've got to do is we've got to eradicate mosquitoes. But Congress did not go along with that. They thought that was stupid. The way you eradicate disease is with medication or with treatment or with, but, you know, what the hell do mosquitoes have to do with it? And there just wasn't an understanding of how infections were transferred. People thought that people got diseases from other people. So they were thinking, we quarantine these people with malaria and we keep them away from everybody else and then malaria won't spread. But they would quarantine them and it didn't do any good, because a mosquito is biting that guy, sucking his blood, taking it, biting the uninfected person and infecting them. And that's what was spreading the disease. Gorgas, you know, at least had a hint that that's where it ought to go. But that's all that's happening in the first 2 years. That's the only bright spot. Other than that, you know, it's business as usual, just pretty much what the French were doing. And even that was hugely underfunded. Okay, along comes John Stevens. And this is just, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, his presidency is on the line here. He promised, we're going to build the Panama Canal. And they're throwing tons of money at it, but it's not making progress. And so he gets his whole cabinet, everybody behind, trying to figure out how do we solve this problem. And they hired this guy, John Stevens. He was a 52-year-old engineer and construction man for the railroads. So he had built major railroad lines, some in the United States, but some in other countries, in particular in the Philippines and in South America. And so he knew about construction abroad. He didn't know anything about digging a canal. He'd never done anything like that. But he did know about building railroads, and that's what most of his career had been. This is an unprepossessing guy. This is not a guy who, if you met him at a party, you'd say, oh my God, guy's freaking brilliant. He was just kind of a really good engineer. He worked for the railroads, and he'd had some success in building these big construction projects. When he was brought in, the U.S. had already spent $128 million, and they had very little to show for it. And so he came in, and this is a creative human being. This guy is not looking at the problem in terms of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom said you do it the way the French did it, you do it the way we've been doing it. You get those drag lines moving, you get that equipment rolling, you move dirt. You've got to move more dirt, you got to do it faster, and that's the solution to the problem. But that was not the approach that John Stevens took. John Stevens had a much more creative approach to the problem, and it involved several different steps. Even when he started, they had made no decision about the route. There were just some fundamental things that were just not working. So he immediately stopped the digging, and this was incredibly controversial. Teddy Roosevelt just about shit a brick. The first thing he does, I hire this new hotshot guy, and the first thing he does is he stops all the digging. All the machinery gets shut down, and we are not doing any digging. And then he starts on several programs. First, he worked on building a railroad, because one of the real problems was getting the workers in and out to the site that they were digging on that day. It was getting equipment from one place to the other to have it dig in the right place at the right time. It was hauling the dirt in and out. What they were doing was digging and then putting the dirt beside the hole they're digging, and then later on they've got to move it again and move it again, and they just were not being strategic about getting all that material out of there. And the railroad was a way to take all that dirt and get it the hell out of there so we never have to deal with it again. And he just realized that in order to make all this work, you needed the railroad to be able to take equipment and people and material in and out. And so the first thing he did was he built a railroad, which he absolutely knew how to do. Then the second thing he did was he worked on creating houses, schools, churches. He realized that I'll never get a workforce here to really do this job if it's crap to live here. People, you know, I want to hire engineers. They were mostly guys. They're not going to move here and leave their families. I need to make an environment where they can bring their family, and there will be schools, and there will be community organizations, there'll be baseball fields, there'll be, you can actually have a life there. This is going to be a long construction project. We can't expect people to just give up their life and come down here and do this unless we make it a reasonable place to live. So he worked on creating these, you can see in the bottom left there, really nice houses and really nice communities and recreation facilities and places where people could have a good life. And then the third thing he did was he started eradicating health problems. And that was a very, very high priority. He got behind William Gorgas and said, okay, this has got to be solved, because I can't ask people to come down here if they're going to catch a tropical disease and we're going to have a problem with people getting sick and dying all the time. So he completely reframed what the problem was. The problem was creating an infrastructure for building the Panama Canal. And then you could build it, and you could build it pretty simply. But until you had that infrastructure, you're just going to be frustrated over and over and over again. So the problem was way too big for one guy, and John Stevens totally understood that. So there's an enormous and complicated team that's working on this project. At the very top of the team is Teddy Roosevelt, who's the president. And he made Teddy Roosevelt his new best friend, and he got his complete support, and he had to win the confidence of Teddy Roosevelt. But Teddy Roosevelt was very much a part of the larger team. Then William Howard Taft, who was Secretary of State, later became president. He needed him because he needed to negotiate initially with Colombia to try to get a route and to get permission to do it. But later on, the actual solution to the problem was, and this was kind of American foreign policy at the time, but they got the people in Panama to revolt against Colombia and establish their own country. So Panama became its own country first, very much encouraged by the State Department. And then they were able to negotiate with the Panamanian government, and everything went much smoother after that. But you had to have William Howard Taft orchestrating this major diplomatic move to support the rebels in Panama and get them separate from Colombia. This was something that John Stevens knew. I'm a freaking engineer. I can't do these big diplomatic moves. I've got to have somebody on the team here who can do these things that I'm not good at. So William Howard Taft was very important. By the way, Ferdinand de Lesseps thought he had to negotiate with the Colombian government. And he didn't find someone else who was really, really good at that and could do it better than him. He tried to do it himself. But John Stevens understands, nope, I need William Howard Taft there. There was this guy, Theodore Shorts, who was head of the Canal Commission. Congress had set up a bureaucracy to oversee the building of the Panama Canal. It was called the Canal Commission. It had lots of political appointees on it, and the head of that Canal Commission was Theodore Shorts. In order to get funding from Congress, John Stevens knew, I have to have the support of the Canal Commission. In order to get support of the Canal Commission, I need Theodore Shorts. Very much involved here, very much a part of the team. So he understands everything that's going on. So he became very much a part of the effort as well. Dr. William Gorgas, who he realized, I got to solve these health issues. Gorgas was the epidemiologist. He was the one who knew the medical and health side of this. Absolutely got to have William Gorgas on the team. Then there are a number of these people who he brought in on his own, wouldn't have inevitably been a part of the process. One was James Hill, which was his old boss when he was building these railroads all over the world. James Hill was his boss, and he thought he was a great boss, he was a great engineer, and he knew his stuff, and so he calls his old boss up, who was retired, and said, man, come out and give me a hand here. I need your help. And James Hill joined the team. A guy named Robert Wood, and he's representative here of a number of young people. So he was 25 years old. He was an up-and-coming young business major. Later on, he would become the head of the largest corporation in America, which was Sears and Roebuck in the 1920s and 1930s. He became a very, very successful captain of industry. But when he's 25 years old, John Stevens is saying, I need you on my team. You're a smart guy. You've got a business head. I want you on my team. And so he was one of his key lieutenants. There were these three other guys, Frank Malthy, William Belding, and Edward Williams, who had particular expertise in organization. One became the division head. In construction, one became the chief of construction, and in finance, and one became the disbursement officer that's really dealing with the money in the whole project. And then there were 2,000 American workers, and he knew that I have to have them on my team, and they have to be happy, and they have to be productive, and they have to be healthy, and so I've got to take care of these people. I've got to recruit them. I've got to make their life desirable. And he understood I need those people on my team. And he worked hard to get an infrastructure that would attract 2,000 American workers, most of them engineers or managers. And then he also needed 20,000 West Indian laborers. Again, he realized I can't get those laborers from the United States because the climate is just so different. They have to be people who are accustomed to the tropics. And local laborers were not possible. So again, he went to the Caribbean, very much the same source that the French were using. But he, very different from the French, had tremendous respect for these common laborers. He needed 20,000 common laborers. And he treated them like princes. He had so much respect for just the hardworking, uneducated laborer who was working on the canal. So one of the things he did was he looked at their diet, and he realized that most of them, having grown up in the Caribbean, they had very, very little protein in their diet. They were mostly eating carbohydrates. And he was more accustomed to an American diet that had more protein in it. And he felt like if they had more protein in their diet, it would give them more stamina. It would help them build muscle where they're doing physical labor. We need to improve their diet. So he actually introduced pork and chicken into their diet much more. They had been eating more like potatoes and plantains and bananas and things like that. And in fact, it improved the health of those workers, and it gave them more stamina and more ability to work harder and longer hours. He also trained them. The French had not been interested in training them, but when somebody came on the job, he immediately thought, we have to show them how to be good workers. So he loved to talk about an instance where he went on to a site where they were digging the old way. They were right when he first started. And he saw four West Indian laborers, and they had been given a wheelbarrow, and they were moving dirt. And what they did was they took their shovels and they filled the wheelbarrow up with dirt. And then one of them got on each of the four corners of the wheelbarrow and they lifted it up and they carried it over and they dumped it out. But they didn't understand how a wheelbarrow worked. That one person can lift it up. It's got a wheel. It rolls like that. And you don't have to lift it up. You can let it still sit on the ground, but you can move it. And one person can do the job that four people were doing. Because they were using the wheelbarrow as a big bucket and not as a wheelbarrow. So, of course, you have to train them. How does this equipment work and how can you work efficiently? And once they got the training, they were fantastic. They were good, hard workers, but it took training. So he brought them on the team as well. This is an extremely people-oriented human being. He understands how to gather together a whole wide range of people, respect them, understand them, see their point of view, and create a larger effort out of that. And that was incredibly key in this case. So he was able to make all of this work through collaboration. And the primary collaboration is happening between John Stevens and Teddy Roosevelt and James Hills. James Hills is this guy that was his old boss. These are people that he considers his equals. I'm not in charge over them. They are absolutely my equals. John Hills used to be my boss. You know, he's an equal. Teddy Roosevelt is the freaking president of the United States. You know, he's got an equal say here. And so he's collaborating with them, and they're working together as a single brain, trying to figure out how to get this done. And he's also doing teamwork. He lets William Gorgas do his thing, even though Stevens wasn't real sure about this mosquito theory. In fact, he was very skeptical about it. And he questioned Gorgas, but in the end he said, you know something? You're the epidemiologist. You're the health expert. I'm not. I'm just a freaking engineer. I'm going to let you play your right tackle position, and I'm not going to get in your face about it. And I'll stand back here and, you know, be the quarterback, but I'm not going to try to play your position. And he let William Gorgas do what he did well. And over, he did that with lots of other people. He knew how to do teamwork and to let individual people have their reign and do what they do without interference. Then the third thing he had was incredible leadership. He could gather this group of lieutenants around him, and all of those people that were 25 years old or 40 years old, and maybe they were the disbursement officer, maybe they were the construction chief, maybe they had their own assignment, but he was leading them. And he knew how to get their respect and to maintain a coordination between them, but he was very much a leader in the effort. And then finally, he did have power. And he knew that he had to have power, and he knew how to play that card and how to exert power. So a couple of instances. At a certain point, Congress wanted to get rid of Gorgas. Gorgas kept coming back to him and saying, I need more money to eradicate mosquitoes. They think that's a stupid idea. What you had to do was get rid of all the pools of water that are sitting around as breeding grounds for mosquitoes. So it's basically a hygiene effort to, you know, get all the tires that are sitting there as refuse in the backyard, and they're collecting water in the middle of the tire, and the mosquitoes are growing there. Or underneath a water faucet, somebody's got a bucket, and it's sitting there, and it's a breeding ground for mosquitoes. He's doing this big hygiene effort to get rid of all the standing water and all the breeding grounds for mosquitoes. It's expensive. It takes a lot of supervision. It takes a lot of manpower. And Congress is just not buying this. And they want to fire his ass. You know, get rid of him. He's an impediment. John Stevens says, no, we are not firing William Gorgas. We're gonna back this guy. And so Congress said, well, if you don't fire him, we're firing you. And John Stevens said, fine, fire me. But I'm not backing down here. We're going to have William Gorgas. As long as I'm on this job, we're having William Gorgas. And Congress backed down. He had the power. Because he was good at what he did, they needed him, and that gave him power. And he knew how to use that power and to stand up to him and say, it's going to be my way or the highway. You don't keep Gorgas, I'm out of here. They also would not appropriate money in Congress for mosquito eradication. So he's got Gorgas, but then he has no money to do it. So he just freaking manipulated the budget. And money that the Congress had allocated for something else, he just reassigned it to mosquito eradication. And that was maybe not by the letter of the law, but he had the power to do it, and he just freaking did it. And because he felt like that had to happen. They also had this problem of, the real problem of root had to do with whether you had locks for the canal or you didn't have locks. What Congress wanted and what the Suez Canal had been was just a big trench between the two bodies of water. And so Congress wanted them to just build a big trench through Panama and connect the two bodies of water. The only thing is there's a mountain range in between there. That is just an incredible amount of dirt to move and make that trench. So it made more sense to John Stevens as an engineer that you create locks. That means that you run on the water up to here, you essentially make a bathtub, and you move the ship into the bathtub. Then you fill the bathtub up with more and more and more water, and that raises the ship up, and you let it exit into a higher body of water. And you made up that 100 feet of difference with a lock. And that way you didn't have to cut out all that dirt. You just slowly take the boat up, and then you take the boat down on the other side. Now, Congress says, that's too messy, it takes too long, we don't want to deal with that. But John Stevens understood the quantity of dirt was just insurmountable. Otherwise, you had to have locks. And there again, Congress didn't want it, but he used his power to say, we're doing it this way. And again, fine, fire me, because if I'm involved here, we're doing it this way. And he got the Canal Commission to back him, and he got the president to back him, and they finally got the route set that way. Now, I think you can see the distinction between these four different ideas of how you work with other people to solve a problem. Now, I want for each of you to think in your head, which of these four things am I best at? Or where do I have a native capability? Do I have a native capability in collaboration, or in teamwork, or in leadership, or in power? And I'm going to ask you, obviously you can have multiple strengths, and I'm just asking you to be a little discriminating here. So how many people think my greatest strength is in collaboration? Raise your hand. Greatest strength is in collaboration. Okay? How many people think my greatest strength is in teamwork? Okay, that's good. Everybody's got to raise their hand one time here. How many people think my greatest strength is in leadership? Okay, that's excellent. How many people think my greatest strength is in exerting power? Okay, that's cool. Now I want us to have just a little discussion of those people who thought their greatest strength was collaboration. I want somebody to explain to me why I think that's my greatest strength and what role you think you could play as a collaborator. So someone who raised their hand for collaboration, pony up here. Okay, good. So what do you think the role of collaboration is, and why do you think you're good at collaboration?
So whenever I collaborate, I like to work with someone who's done the exact same task for longer and someone who's just coming into it. Mm-hmm. If I have somebody who's been doing it longer than I have, I always have like the benefit of their wisdom and experience. Mm-hmm. And if you have someone who's just coming into the field, usually they have innovations that neither of us have. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a range of skill across like different ages.
So that it's really the most fertile environment for you is it's a range of different people. They bring something to the table, but together you kind of have a mind meld and you can all work for the best result. Excellent. Somebody else who feels like collaboration is a key element and that's something they're comfortable with. Okay, we're going to move on. So who's someone who raised their hand on teamwork? How do you think teamwork works, and why do you think this is something you're comfortable with? Okay. There were a ton of you who said teamwork was something you were comfortable with, so what do you think?
I think it feels best and most natural to work in a team in which people can work to their own individual understandings and strengths.
So have you had experience working on teams where you felt, that feels really comfortable, I like that. So tell me about that.
I'm in an FRI stream, which is the Freshman Research Initiative, and I'm in a small team that we do research with, and so we can each work to our own strengths. Like, one of our members does mainly data analysis, while some of us do more of the collection or the planning for it.
Excellent. Really, really good example of that. Who's somebody else who maybe felt a strength in teamwork? Come on, guys. Pony up here. Okay, we'll pass on teamwork. Got one good input on both of those. So on leadership, who's someone who feels comfortable with leadership, and why does that seem to be a role that fits and works for you? What do you think?
So I find whenever I'm in a group environment with other people, I tend to be the one to make sure that we get all our stuff done on time while not infringing on anyone's like creative ideas. I'm more just trying to like guide the group to the end goal.
Okay, so you feel really comfortable assessing other people's strengths and laying out paths and coordinating, and that's a clear leadership role. What about somebody else? Anybody else who raise their hand on leadership? Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I'm really detail-oriented, so I can see when I'm in a group, sometimes people just look at the broad picture and they all just start going in their own directions. And then I can tend to see the bigger picture and make it more narrow and kind of assign things to people that they maybe forgot that we even have to do and stick to deadlines. So I think that's a strength of mine.
Excellent. That's managerial capability, which is leadership requires that. Okay, I was actually extremely pleased that there were a number of people who raised their hand on power. Who is someone who you feel like, I understand what this is and I feel comfortable exercising it and has some sense of how that might work for you? So what do you think?
I've always been fairly stubborn, and so I find it really natural to stand my ground when I find myself seeing something that I know the people around me don't see yet, or are seeing in a different way that I don't necessarily agree with.
Okay, so if you're willing to stick up there, and sometimes it takes some stubbornness to stick up and say, okay, look, it has to be this way, and that's exerting power. That's basically speaking truth to power and, you know, getting the extra benefit that comes from that kind of exertion. Other people who might have seen power as a useful tool. Okay, so I think it's really important to think through in this larger sense, especially if you're interested in solving problems at a scale that's significant and that makes a difference in the world, to figure out how you work with other people in this regard. I have just this enormous admiration for John Stevens. He's like a total hero for me, for somebody to walk into that situation and to strategize in an extremely creative way, how are we going to get this done? And then to orchestrate this big complex team and be able to get it going. And he really just spent about 3 years doing that. And then he had Teddy Roosevelt come down and visit the Panama Canal construction. This is Teddy on one of the dragline machines. It was a huge kind of PR move to try to get support from the American people and from Congress for continuing to fund this thing. It was the first time an American president had ever left the United States and gone somewhere else in the world. So it was a really momentous, big news event when Teddy Roosevelt came down to the Panama construction. And then shortly after that, John Stevens resigned. And it just broke Teddy Roosevelt's heart. He was his man, and he just was devastated by it. But it was kind of essential, John Stevens thought, to get this thing going, to get the problem solved. But then he had, you know, a personal life as well. His family, his wife, did not like living in Panama, and so he had a personal life, and he had a commitment to his family, and he realized that they've sacrificed for me for these 3 years. I've got to pay attention to them, and so some of these personal issues led him to resign. He also was just totally exhausted. I mean, the guy had just worked his butt off trying to make this happen and get it all organized. And he realized, I'm at a point of exhaustion now. I have to move on to something else. He also was just a bit of a rebel. He was a guy for getting things going. But he didn't want to just be the steady state guy who just kind of kept the machine running. He wanted to go out and find another challenge that would require his creative abilities to solve some other problem. So he resigned in 1907, but he had established this team and this effort and this kind of machine so that George Washington Goodell assumed control of the project and takes advantage of Stevens' well-oiled machine and pretty much keeps the same personnel in place. And the Army Corps of Engineers took over the project and completed the canal. It took another 8 years or something like that. But it was really all John Stevens' effort that was the creative impetus that made that thing happen. And they just recently redid the Panama Canal. But, you know, for 80 years, that thing just existed as the brainchild of John Stevens, and served its purpose to completely transform trade routes in the world for all those decades. But not possible without relinquishing complete control as he did.